Your Honor, James Beck, on behalf of the appellant, Sherry Fernstahl, who is guardian ad litem for her minor child, CF, I'd ask to have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Your Honors, the question before you today in this case is whether under a remedial statute, RCW 9.68A130.
With regard to your argument that the trial court should have engaged in fact-finding here, I'm curious about what the target of the trial court's fact-finding would be. Is the responsibility of the trial judge to find as a fact what the jury decided was proved, or is it an independent factual inquiry free of the jury's findings based on the same evidence?
I don't want to evade the question.
I don't want you to either, so please
just
answer
it. As a threshold piece, it's not our position that it would be fact-finding necessary exactly in this case, but it would be a matter of law nonetheless, to be direct here. The question would be based on the evidence that was presented in a hearing post-judgment.
So it would be different evidence?
Potentially. Whatever was necessary and in that adjudication. It's a question of civil procedure. And once the motion is filed, and it's dictated by motion practice, depending on what's raised.
I understand that's your impression. I'm just trying to find out how you see it work. Now, you argue that it's de novo review.
Correct.
Okay. So the trial judge would have this hearing, presumably would be allowed to consider the evidence presented to the jury. Is that what you envision?
If necessary.
Okay. And would consider whatever other evidence was presented at the hearing, would then make factual findings. Then on appeal, we would not be at all influenced in any way by the factual findings that the trial judge made, and instead, without seeing any of the witnesses, we would, because it's de novo review, we would read the transcript and decide who we thought was lying and who was telling the truth and make our own factual findings to determine that if we come out the same way, right? That's how it would work on de novo review.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree in the sense that this is really akin, and we briefed this with the same thing as the tolling statute for bringing a case by a minor victim of sexual assault. It's the same underlying statute with subchapter 090. And so the question, if this minor had been 25, and a lot of these cases arise.
Are we going to get to the point where you answer the question I asked you sometime soon? My question had to do with, you have a vision of how this should work in the trial court. Then you tell us that it's de novo review. I've expressed to you what that means to us, what our responsibility would be on de novo review. And now is your opportunity to tell me, yes, Judge Dwyer, that's exactly how I expect that this would work.
If it came down in that situation, you would be reviewing it, I think, for substantial evidence.
Well, that's not de novo review.
Well, it agreed, and it would depend on how it were to come about in the first part, which is why I was trying to explain the equivalency and the analogous nature of the tolling
statute. For it to work your way, we'd have to alter our standards of review to accommodate how you envision that it works.
No. This court doesn't look at questions under a abuse of discretion standard when there's a case that's brought by a minor that says, I was subject to childhood sex abuse. The court looks at the circumstance and asks, what's the gravamen of this complaint? And is the gravamen something that would trigger it? And it's the exact same standard. Under CJC in 1999, the Supreme Court said the communications with a minor for immoral purposes. That's a court threshold decision.
So the jury has really no role in this, right?
No, it doesn't. It's a cost statute. And under our rules, which are analogous to the federal rules, under CR 54D, it is motion practice to go to the courts. It's exactly how three federal judges who have looked at this.
So is your, well, we can talk about that later. So is it your impression that any civil action that involves any type of alleged child sexual abuse falls within the scope of this statute?
if the conduct would constitute a violation of that chapter, which a large part it would be, yes. I mean, you're asking as an absolute.
Well, yeah, I am. I am asking as an absolute.
If
the answer to the question answered in the absolute is no, right? If the underlying crime was child rape in the first degree, that is prohibited under the provisions of Title IX-A.
Correct.
And correct. So that would not support an award of fees.
No, the same. It would. The same conduct would also be a violation of the immoral purposes statute. If you look at CJC again, the conduct there was masturbation of a child, and that's nothing that's specifically targeted other than. Let's see how to better put this. The communications with a moral for improper purposes would be a offense that would be a underlying offense in the criminal context.
The judge can know what you alleged, I guess. How does the judge know what you proved without asking the jury?
The question isn't what was in the jury's mind.
Well, that's so you say, but the jury is the fact finder in a jury trial. So how does the judge know what the jury found to be proved in the scenario that you have expressed?
Well, they don't, and I understand.
So the judge doesn't know what was proved. The judge only knows what you allege.
The judge cannot be a mind reader of the jury, but the rules. The
no, judges know what juries decided all the time. It doesn't involve mind reading. You give an instruction, you ask a question. And the jury tells you what they found. That's happening somewhere at 3rd and James, right, as we speak.
There's no fee provision cost statute that anybody's briefed that would require some additional fact-finding piece beyond the causes of action alleged. There is no cause of action under 968A chapter. It's criminal code.
Right.
The trial court was concerned and said, look, I can't consider this because you didn't bring a cause of action in this criminal chapter. There is no cause of action to bring. This isn't, we're not a criminal prosecutor, it's not a criminal case. The claims of assault and battery are the types you would expect. Thank you.
You have your rebuttal time.
Thomas McCurdy on behalf of Respondent Johnny Barr. May it please the court, I would ask that you affirm the trial court order denying appellant's motion for fees and costs under RCW 9.68A, Section 130. The entitlement to fees under that section was not established. The prerequisite.
Who would have to find the factual basis to say that it was established?
Either the criminal court, in this case the district court, or the jury.
When you say the criminal court, you mean you're talking about issue preclusion?
No, I'm saying that the plaintiff could come forward, the appellant could come forward and assert civil causes of action of assault and battery, and, you know, after a finding somewhere, I guess.
Well, it sounds to me like you're talking about issue preclusion, that if he was found to be guilty, then he'd be precluded from arguing that he was guilty because it was established. And so the issue would be precluded from litigation, and some would be entitled to a summary judgment ruling that it was so.
Yes.
Okay. So setting aside issue preclusion, which isn't really dealing with fact-finding, whose role is it to find what's proved in the lawsuit?
The jury, through the special verdict form. And I think we can look at the procedure envisioned by CR 54 to really, you know, understand why that is the case. The Reardon
case, you envision something like an interrogatory that would say, as to any of the claims on which you ruled in favor of the plaintiff, do you find that it was based on evidence establishing and then set forth the elements of communicating with a minor for unlawful purposes in this case? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes.
And the jury would be required to answer yes or no?
Yes. And I think the evidentiary presentation, the evidence that would be presented in connection with a CR 54 motion, as Reardon discusses, is evidence to establish the amount of the fee, just as there was in this case, both the appellant and respondents submitted evidence in the form of...
Whether the hours are reasonable, whether the rates are that
yes.
sort of thing.
Yes. yes.
How there seems to be a an impression that only criminal prosecutors could bring questions to the jury arising out of Chapter 68A of this title. How would you envision that the evidence would necessarily evidence presented would be different, or is it an unknown whether it would be different? If you had been apprised that the jury would be asked the question that I hypothesized about a moment ago.
It's an unresolved issue, as we know. I think the opinions that exist that have been cited by the appellant and respondents discuss the availability of a civil claim arising out of an 090 violation, specifically the gross misdemeanor section. The evidence, I believe, would be the same. The question that
what might be
would be the burden.
What might be different might be evidence as to the mental state of the person whose actions were in question, to see whether he had the mental state required by the provisions of Chapter 68A.
Perhaps. I think there would need to be a specific finding by the trier of fact in order to establish that.
And that was otherwise not at issue in this case.
It was not an issue. Now, there was evidence presented and evidence that was disputed. I mean, there was conflicting evidence. There was no finding by the jury. You cannot infer a violation of the act based on the jury's findings of liability for civil assault, civil battery. And you can't based on what the jury did not find, which was no liability for false imprisonment.
The trial court here did not make any factual findings about what the trial judge believed to be true or untrue, other than I, the trial judge, looking at the verdicts, do not have a belief as to whether the jury found something that would constitute a violation of Chapter 68A to have been proved.
Not only do I not have a belief, but I cannot form a belief based on the information before me. I would.
So it wasn't a refusal to decide. There was a decision.
Absolutely. Thank you. Unless you have any other questions, I'll allow my colleague the rest of the time.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Sally Layton. I represent the defendant Subar and the Puyallup Basketball Academy. I think your question has been specifically addressed by the court in the Kuhn versus Schnall case. In that case, the jury found that Dr. Schnall was largely liable to the four plaintiff patients for violation of the standard of care and for negligent infliction of emotional distress. And then the jury was required to specifically answer the question whether Dr. Schnall's communication with these minor patients was for an immoral purpose of a sexual nature. And they said no. They specifically addressed the question and specifically answered it no. So there was a verdict for the plaintiffs, but not on the 968A statute. And that's the problem in this case for the plaintiff. That question was not submitted to the jury. The defense is not saying that the jury decides whether or not fees and costs are allowed. But the jury must decide whether or not the statute.
But counsel would say that what happened in Schnall was wrong, that once the jury returned those underlying verdicts, their role was finished. And in that case, it should have been the trial judge to determine what was proved based on either the evidence at trial or on additional evidence at a hearing. Why is he wrong in that belief?
Because it's a factual determination. And the factual determination must be made by the trier of fact, which is the jury. In this case, the jury decided against my client, Sue Barr, on the claim of invasion of privacy by false light. And there were a dozen witnesses that testified about things that Subar, my client, said or that they heard or understood that happened. And that testimony for that tort, invasion of privacy by false light, allowed emotional damages for CF that were related to her emotional injuries for feeling that people were talking about her, that she had been shunned, children wouldn't play with her, parents wouldn't allow them to play with her, and because of comments that were made that put her in a false light. The jury found in favor of the plaintiff on that claim, and they also found in favor of against my client, the Puyallup Basketball Academy, on the issue of negligence. But neither invasion of privacy by false light or negligence are communication with a minor for immoral purposes. That issue was not decided. For whatever reason, the plaintiff decided not to pursue that issue at trial or simply forgot to do so. The jury returned a verdict of $225,000 in favor of CF, but they didn't say, they didn't explain, they weren't asked what the basis of that verdict was, whether it was the invasion of privacy by false light, whether it was negligence, whether it was a simple assault and battery against John Barr. That question, that 9.68A, must be answered according to that statute in order to find a violation and to kick in the attorney's fees and costs is whether or not there was communication with a minor for immoral purposes, and that must be decided by the trier of fact, and it simply was not. What plaintiff is asking the court, first the trial court to do, and Judge Lee Anderson refused to do so, and now here asking you to do, is to make that factual determination of what the jury decided and what was proved at trial, and that can't be done after the fact. Not by the trial court and not by the appellate court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. The Kahn case that was mentioned before, there's no part of that decision that informs this. There's lawyer's conduct about tracking, more or less, Judge Dreyer, how you explained in some of your questioning, suggesting how this would happen. But it wasn't a court-approved process, and it wasn't part of this appeal. It has no precedential value here today, other than that's how some lawyers agreed to handle this situation in a previous case. There is no precedent for an attorney's fee statute
to be some judge determined to handle the situation in a previous case.
That's true.
I think that's more precise.
Fair enough. However, there's no situation other than that trial judge, which was not reviewed on appeal, isn't binding authority on anybody, and stands in contrast to other trial judges that we pointed to in the federal system.
Well, the federal judges, what they appear to say is, later on we may have some briefing on this. They don't ask for briefing at the time. They don't make any, certainly don't make any dispositive rulings. All the commonality in the three things that you cited to us were, yeah, we'll let you brief it later on.
The Rodin case from 2009, Ninth Circuit case, that lays out the framework very directly under the analogous federal rule would inform that as well. But in this case, we're asking, the suggestion is...
I don't know what you mean, the analogous. Are you saying there's an analogous federal statute, or you're just talking about the rule that's similar to Rule 54?
Our Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54 and CR 54 are analogous, okay. And therefore precedent would say we should, you know, consider that as persuasive authority for the procedure for handling something like this. There is no other...
Jury trial right in... Federal court's the same as the jury trial right in Washington?
It is a different situation. But let's go right there, because I think that's something that underpins this. Is there a right to trial by jury to understand whether this cost statute is triggered? That may be, you know, the most linchpin piece of this. This court just previous to this argument was...
How opposing counsel would phrase that question is, can there be a cost statute giving a right to an award of fees in the absence of a factual determination by a jury of the predicate factual necessity.
And let's take for consideration one of the cases you were hearing just before this, where you're deciding whether or not the frivolous claim statute applies. A court, not a jury, would make that decision. And since this state's territorial times, courts have been empowered to determine whether or not fee provisions, cost provisions are triggered, not just the amount of costs. It's different if it's an element of damages. Clearly not the case here. We'd ask that you reverse.
Thank you, counsel. The next